Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
October 14th, 2011, the Norris Group returns with its award-winning event, I Survived Real Estate. An expert lineup of industry specialists join Bruce Norris to discuss current industry regulation, head-scratching legislation, and the opportunities emerging for savvy real estate professionals. 100% of the proceeds support the Orange County affiliate of Susan G. Komen for The Cure. This event would not be possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Foreclosure Radar and Sean O'Toole, Housing Wire, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association and President Bill Tan, Investors Workshops and President Sean Watkins and Angel Bronkiest, Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration and Bobby Alexander, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Berry, Real Wealth Networks, Fry Wiles Web and Branding, MVT Productions, and White House Catering, who will provide the three-course meal for this black tie event. Visit iSurvived2011.com for more details.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our special guest is Eric Jensen. Eric is an economic and financial market analyst, author, and speaker with more than 28 years of executive experience in high technology startup companies, venture capital, finance, and economics. Founder and president of iTulip Inc., a data-driven economic analysis firm. Started as a website, iTulip.com, in 1998. Jensen is widely recognized for more than a decade of accurate forecast of major economic and market trends. And he's also written in 2010 a book that I've enjoyed, well, reading. It's a tough read, in some ways, the post-catastrophe economy. Eric, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate you having me on.
I guess the first thing I want to do is ask about how you came up with the name iTulip. It's an unusual name if people aren't used to that story.
Yeah, it's a old story. I started the site back in 1998 when I was the managing director of a seed stage venture capital firm called Osborne Capital. And we invested in 20 companies, startup companies, mostly friends of mine and my friend Jeff that we'd known out of the industry. And the fund did quite well. We had seven liquidity events out of those 20 companies, you know, sales of Cisco, a couple IPOs, Nortel, Microsoft. We did quite well. The purpose of iTulip was it was a way to publish the research I was doing when I was running Osborne Capital that was steering me in the direction of concluding that we were participating in a bubble,
okay,
a tech bubble. So iTulip is a takeoff on the tulip mania,
yes,
that happened in the Netherlands in the 1630s. The I being, if you remember back in those days, it was traditional to put an I or an E in front of everything and, you know, come up with a dot-com version of everything in the world.
What was interesting when I read about the tulip mania is that it seemed reasonable for other people to participate in it. As a real estate investor, you know, you kind of rely on comps, and comps are
right,
the past decisions of other people. And I remember in one of the books looking at an actual transaction where a tulip bulb was exchanged for everything the man owned, 50
right,
acres, a barn, cattle, and that must have seemed like a reasonable transaction,
sure,
market value, if you will. And I guess my question is, what did we learn about human nature when we look at that tulip mania period?
Well, it's interesting, Bruce. The human nature part of it, and I've studied lots of different kinds of bubbles, and they're all very different from each other depending on the asset class. So commodity bubbles are very different from stock market bubbles, from property bubbles of various kinds. And so the role of the retail participant is different in each case as well, although it tends to be similar in a lot of ways. So the tech bubble ran on a recycling of money from IPOs back into the venture capital industry, back into more startups. And that's a typical characteristic of a bubble, is they run on their own. They start to generate their own fuel, their own money. They don't need an outside source, but they're always triggered by some sort of outside event. In the case of the tulip bulb mania, the discovery, the simultaneous discovery of these tulip bulbs, and also a bond that was floated by the government that produced a big surge in the money supply. And it's usually some distortion that occurs in the bond markets or in the equity markets combined with some sort of discovery that, that gets the ball rolling. And in the case of the housing bubble, it was the securitized debt, the introduction of securitized debt, and, of course, as we know, the mispricing and misrating of it that fueled the beginnings of that bubble, which is, again, was reinforced by monetary policy and regulatory policy. The retail investor doesn't get in on it until the prices have been going up for a while and a bunch of memes started to develop in the mostly in the mainstream media to reinforce this trend of rising prices.
You know, you can understand the attraction of participating in a bubble because it's exciting. And it gives the regular guy hope to escape the daily grind because everyone around him seems to be cashing big checks. And
sure.
So you go through one, in say 2000. I'll share a kind of a sad story. It's funny though in a way because I learned a lot. I wasn't a stock investor, and I had a relative invest in penny stocks in late 1999, and everything he touched doubled. And so I became curious, and I had a lot of real estate at the time. So anyway, I took $250,000, put it with Merrill Lynch, and about 40 days turned it into $800,000. And I thought I was probably, a pretty wise stock picker. So I actually started writing an outline for a penny stock course. And I didn't get to finish it until my $800,000 turned into $100,000. Mm. But it was an exciting period, and I really learned a lot about the emotional cycle of investing. Now, real estate's
sure.
my field, so I was able to get off of the bandwagon in time. But you can understand the emotion that goes on in it where you're enjoying participating, and if you don't have a real exit, like you understood the stock market was a bubble. I just didn't. I understood the real estate was a bubble, but you can understand the attraction anyway, but the damage
sure.
path probably hurts more people than it helps, I guess. Is that usually the conclusion of a bubble?
Absolutely. It's frankly, they're wealth transfer mechanisms. If you want to be cynical about it, and I'm not sure it is cynical. I think it actually is the fact that these bubbles are primarily manufactured. So let me give you the case of the one that I personally participated in, which was the tech bubble.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm on the boards of these companies that we've invested in. And it's not just the retail investor that gets caught up in it. It's very sophisticated institutional investors get caught up in it, too. So I was watching a group of otherwise very intelligent and thoughtful people believe in a whole bunch of fallacies, right? One of our deals was a company called Arrowpoint, and we got I think it was about a 220x return for that investment.
Okay.
Now, the trick was, and this was the reason for my, I knew there was something amiss because that was not rational pricing. And the way that pricing typically gets irrational during a bubble is, first of all, the desire for it to continue, and it's infectious, and this idea that you can get rich quick is pretty hard for humans to avoid, whether they're gambling or whatever they're doing. And so people want to believe. So there's a bias toward belief anyway. Now, by my personality, tend to be a skeptical person, and I was on these boards, and I was thinking, boy, there's just something wrong here. So I started to research it, and it became very clear to me, not only that it was a bubble, but I had a pretty good sense of when it was going to end as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I tore up in March of 2000. I said, if you're still in, this is your last chance to get out. You really should be out of here by the end of March or April at the latest. And we sold all of our positions from our sales to Cisco and Microsoft and other companies in April, May, and June of 2000. So we were able to capture the gains that we made in that period. And then I started to watch the housing market go up, and I wrote my first piece about the housing bubble in August of 2000. I said, we're at the early stages of a housing bubble. It will probably go on for 3 or 4 years, but it has a very different dynamic than a stock market bubble for a bunch of reasons, one of them being that it's debt financed.
Yeah, I was going to say it can be leveraged so much.
Exactly. So there's going to be a lot of leverage, which means when it crashes, it's going to be macroeconomically very bad. It's going to be bad for the banking system and much worse for the economy than the stock market bubble was.
Well, and like you said, it sort of had to have the cooperation of policymakers, which is
yeah.
kind of odd to me because there's a history of these don't work out too well. The aftermath of a bubble is not pleasant, and you think we would learn to make smarter decisions, but we didn't.
Well, if you go back and read some of the articles I was writing around the year when I met Sean O'Toole back in the year 2000, my warning was, look, you know, if we don't rein in this housing bubble and it goes to its logical conclusion, what's going to happen is that we're going to have a massive financial crisis and an economic crisis. And I also put that together into a more formal presentation when I was working as the entrepreneur in residence for Trident Capital, which is a very large venture capital firm in Connecticut. This was to help them time their exits and their liquidity issues. But fundamentally, my theory was if this is allowed to run to its logical conclusion, then we'll have a very unconstructive conversation later on about how to prevent it. And usually what happens is, with Sarbanes-Oxley was the answer to the stock market bubble, which I call the Accountants Full Employment Act. I don't think it'll ever prevent anything, but it's going to make people feel better politically. And my warning about the housing bubble is after that pops, there's going to be a massive populist movement to try to rein in the banks and rein in the lenders and constrain the housing industry exactly at the point where the opposite should be done. So there'll be, instead of having a counter-cyclical policy response, it'll be a pro-cyclical response. It'll make the housing crash even worse.
I didn't realize you were going to say something like that, because I completely agree with what you just said. There's movement now to make it very difficult, let's say in the future, to buy real estate with big down payments exactly at the time the payment's less than rent.
Yeah, and this, you know, and I'll tell you, Bruce, that the stunning thing about it is the utter predictability of it. I mean, I was telling audiences this back in 2005, that this is how it was going to work out. And this is because this is how our political economy It, the way to think about itulip.com, it's a bit unusual. It's not a traditional finance and economic site. We attempt to understand the underlying process of our political economy and this interaction between markets and policy within our political system, and therefore how markets will tend to respond later on and how to allocate capital along those lines. So this... you know, here we are in the situation where the housing market is, you know, I was just doing some research for an article I'm writing, is, you know, as bad as it's been in recent memory, and it's not recovering. Particularly residential construction spending is back where it was in 1996.
Well, and there's no way that you're going to have construction pick up. I'll give you an example. I live in California. Riverside County has been damaged by, say, 60-65%, which is the price of a home now, even built, say, in 2004 or 5, which is pretty new, is selling for maybe half of replacement cost. But the one thing I hadn't really thought about when I looked at this foreclosure list growing is that it represented every time a property sold. I'll give you an example. 1,000 homes selling in Riverside, 70% of them are either short sales or an REO. So 70% of the closings don't reproduce a buyer.
Right.
They produce a renter.
Yep.
Or somebody that can no longer be a household and they move in with someone else. So our short run problem is we've got a lot of inventory that's being presented and a refusal to have financing for investors because they're viewed as speculators.
Right.
So you really have a challenge because you don't have people migrating to Riverside when it's got 15% unemployment.
Yep.
So there does have to be some calmer heads prevail and some common sense decisions made.
And that's the problem, because what happens when you have a market event like the housing bubble collapse that causes major macroeconomic distortions and a big downturn and unemployment? Unemployment is the most politically difficult change in an economy for politicians to deal with. You're not going to get elected,
right?
If you don't help solve an unemployment problem. If you want to understand what's really going on in our political system right now, it's all about long-term unemployment. If you look at the mean duration of unemployment today, it's even worse than it was when the recession started. It just keeps going up and up and up. So this represents a large and growing pool of very unhappy people who are looking for a quick fix, most of whom really didn't think very much about economic issues or about markets, and so they're listening for different voices out there, and the voices that they're going to tend to respond to the most are the populist voices. voices that say, you know, we should just come down hard on the real estate industry and come down on the banks and blah blah blah. Instead of saying, look, and just leveling the American people, saying, here's the mistake that was made, here's how we got where we are, and here are some viable paths out of this. But if we sit around trying to figure out who's to blame, we're just never going to get out of it. It's just going to keep getting worse.
Real estate was a big participant in what you refer to as the FIRE economy. So we kind of grew up with that. So for 30 years, that's been going on, where real estate, insurance, financing, I mean, that's all been part of what we were accustomed to. So you think the next 10 years are going to be very different than the last 30?
Well, you know, when I wrote the book back in 2008 and 2009, it came out in 2010, my thinking was that after this crisis occurred, that this would be a forcing function for some significant change in the structure of the economy, that there would be a political forcing function that would enable the next leader of the country and members of Congress to stand up and say, look, here's what is amiss with the structure of our economy. Here's what we can do to get it aimed in the right direction so that a couple of years from now, by 2011, 2012, the economy will be growing 3-4% a year, jobs will be coming back, the economy will be back headed in the right direction. But since then, starting around early 2010, it became apparent to me that none of that was going to be done, that the leadership was not even framing the problem in terms, and it was an attempt to restart the economy that we've been running on for 30 years, which had reached a crisis and point in 2007, and is not, we can't resuscitate it. So now we've wasted years and also a considerable amount of public credit in attempting to start an economy that is not sustainable, and now we have much fewer options and even less time.
Well, what's likely to make that change in the right direction? Do we absolutely need a crisis?
Well, you know, Bruce, I've asked that question to a lot of people in interviews during when I was writing the book and then afterwards. I name a couple of people I've talked to, a short conversation with Paul Volcker, long conversation with former Senator Bill Graham, who's now the vice chairman of UBS, and a bunch of others. And the general consensus is that, yes, we have to have a crisis that's even worse than we had in 2008, 2009, to, in the words of one of those gentlemen, get everyone kneeling at the cross and coming up with a solution to get out of the crisis. But everyone has to be affected equally, and the political pain has to be more shared than it is today, because that's why we can't get a consensus even on what the problem is, never mind how to fix the problem.
I think one of the things that I was most impressed with in the book, reading The Post-Catastrophe Economy, was that you really view America as having the legacy of treating everyone equally and giving everyone a shot. And that's where the roots we have to go back to is resurrect that entrepreneurial spirit and be willing to put infrastructure in place that goes to the future instead of what you were just talking about, thinking we're going to resurrect what was working for the last 30 years. We have to start thinking about maybe what doesn't even exist today, but we know can exist.
Yes. If we had, instead of some ad hoc, road fixing and other kinds of fiscal stimulus projects, and instead had invested in bolder projects which were intended to make the U.S. more competitive, if the higher-level goal wasn't let's create jobs and hope that we can muddle through for the next few years until the next election, but if the thinking was, okay, how do we square this country to be competitive in 10 years? What will be the issues facing us? And the issues will be things like very high energy costs, a need, heavy global competition for brains, for the smartest people in the world, which we traditionally have won, but over the last 10 years have been starting to lose, get those differentiators back. If we'd done that, I wouldn't be looking at a chart like I'm looking at today, where public spending has been on construction has been steadily declining since the end of the recession. It should be growing, particularly if private spending on construction is continuing to decline. That just shows very, very bad planning and unclear thinking about what has to be done to get the economy going again.
We've been in what you call the fire economy. You're wanting us to get to the TECI economy, where we're dealing with transportation, energy, and communication infrastructure. But in the meantime, we're going to get stuck in this transitional economy. So what's going to be probably a wise investment strategy for the next decade? Caution?
Well, that's a very challenging question because, you know, back when we were doing our forecasting around the tech bubble and then the housing bubble, and we shorted the S&P 40% in December of 2007. We just thought it was going to get hammered in 2008. All those forecasts and decisions were based on an understanding of the cycle of asset price inflations, crashes, and then reflation via monetary and fiscal policy. Today, the challenge is that clearly the economy is weakening, but we don't have the option of spending our way out of it the way before. Our credit isn't strong enough, and if we try to do that, it's very likely that we'll start to see interest rates go up, and then we go into this kind of cycle that we see in countries like Greece and elsewhere, when you simply don't have enough economic growth to credibly finance the existing debt that's already out there, never mind take on new debt.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing we did on Osborne Capital and iTulip is we made a huge bet on gold back in 2001, which has turned out to be doing quite well. And I would say that very unfortunately, because I perceive a rise in gold prices and the current trend of national governments becoming net buyers versus sellers of gold, which has been happening since the first quarter of 2009, as a very, very bad omen and a trend that indicates the extent and severity of the failure of public policy and leadership, not just in the U.S., but in other countries too.
We've only got a minute left. Europe's problems, they have a chance to spill over and cause grief for here?
Absolutely. I just got back from a trip to Europe, and it's quite clear that there's a tremendous amount of anxiety about how they solve their debt problems politically. The reason the German people are so upset about Germany carrying the load here is that everyone knows that the top 5-10% of Greek wealth group doesn't really pay any taxes.
Okay.
And so when the idea of austerity comes up, the rest of the population knows that they've been carrying the load anyway, and now they're being asked to pay even more and get even less.
And we've got to end it there. But Eric, what you're saying is that honestly, there's two separate worlds now, the people that have and people that don't, and there's going to be some political and societal upheaval for that. I wish we had more time, and I'm so glad you're on the panel at the Nixon Library event October 14th. Eric Jensen, great book, The Post-Catastrophe Economy, and a fantastic website. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate 2011. Adrenaline Athletics, Caldwell Banker Pioneer Real Estate, Conaway and Conaway, Del May Properties, Elite Auctions, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Keller Williams of Corona, Keystone CPA, Kukan and Clark Partners LLC, Las Brisas Escrow, Lievis Associates, Mike Cantu, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Pacific Sunrise Mortgage, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southwest Riverside County Board of Realtors, Stars Photography, UDirect IRA, Wilson Investment Properties, Tony Alvarez, and Weston South Coast Plaza. Visit iSurvived2011.com for more details.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.